Hi, who's the guy to call?
Hey, this is Xander. I won't be able to be on for the whole call, but wanted to accept a little bit.
Okay.
Hello, Xander.
Okay, so, this is the 902 teleconference for 26th of, is it 26th or 27th?
27th.
27th of April, 2016, Century 1 negotiating, very loyal secretary. You want to call the real Fred and see if you got everybody?
Okay, I'll read the names I've written down, and if I miss somebody, you can tell me who you are. Craig McKee, Ken Freeland, Jonathan Mark, Cheryl Curtis, Tony Rook, Dan Hennen, James Hufford, Lynn Bradbury, Xander Arena, Frank Tolopko, David Cole, Steve Cohn, Mike Cook, John O'Malley, Wayne Costi, Sue Serpa, Rich O'Coin, and Barton Bruce. Did I miss anybody?
Dave Schlesinger.
Dave Schlesinger, okay. So I guess we got everybody.
Okay, thank you, Craig. All right, now we move on to the agenda. Are there any amendments to the draft agenda before we proceed?
Dave Schlesinger, I had asked for time, but I'm willing to defer. I'm still concerned about misunderstandings, but it was proposed that I propose a time to discuss organizing in general, and as long as the things that I was concerned about are allowed to be part of that, I'm happy to do it that way at a future meeting.
Okay, well, just send me an email and we'll go from there, okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Lynn Bradbury.
Lynn Bradbury.
I'd like to request that we postpone the 28 pages update until next month's call.
Okay. Are there any objections to postponing the 28 pages update until next month's call? Okay. Here, none of them. Just drop that item from the agenda for tonight and go on to any other amendments to the agenda. All right, here, now then, let's proceed. Our first item, our featured item for tonight, is we want to give a very warm welcome to our honored guest from Great Britain. That would be Tony Rook. And here to introduce him is the person whose energies went into initially organizing this teleconference, Jonathan Mark. Jonathan?
Thank you, Ken. I met Tony just from his movie, and I found out that Selmite did a movie for police and firefighters, but the key element that he produced in his film was incontrovertible evidence, and within that, he had a story of going to and refusing to pay his BBC payment TV bill in order to highlight the complicity of the mainstream media and having foreknowledge of World Trade Center 7, Building 7. He's gotten some really good reviews, and we jumped on this film because it's something that has music and goes into great depth. I'd like to just read a little bit from this review that James McDowell wrote that tells a lot about this film. And the article was called, of this review, Seeing Through the Miracles of 9/11. From its artful cinematography to its rich underscore, Incontrovertible is an inspired and well-researched documentary that reaches its viewers on multiple levels with layered messages. And so I'm going to, after Tony gives a review of more about his film and answers some questions, I'd like to share a little bit more of our campaign to bring his DVD to police and fire stations, and we're also giving us a screening of this film on May 21st in Greenville, Mass. So, Tony, can you take it over and give us the whole gist?
Yeah, cheers, Jonathan, thanks. Yeah, I mean, well, what do you want to know? Do you want to know the background of the film or more about the BBC case? Or?
I would think, you know, like, well, a lot of people call your film is one of the best 9/11 movies, so what did you, like, know, how were you able to produce such a good film? I know you were a former police officer, and you had the...
No, I wasn't. I'm not a former police officer. My father was.
Oh, your father was. All right.
My father was a former police officer, yeah. No, crikey, no, they wouldn't have me.
You had a musician, or, and expanded that, or how did you get into this realm of filmmaking?
I mean, I have a background, with, believe it or not, I used to work for the BBC in the 1980s, well before 9/11, and I was only a clerk there. I was only pushing a pen around. I was in my 20s, but I'd always been interested in screenwriting and music, and I'd written some little TV series and some independent films before I went on to do anything to do with 9/11. And then, of course, in 2013, as you guys probably know, you have a thing in the UK now. If you want to watch television, you have to pay a TV license fee, and anyone who buys a TV in England has to pay. It's £140 a year at the moment, and all that money goes to the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, because it's. Publicly funded, it's meant to be impartial and all this crap. They don't have any advertising on there like normal television, so you don't get commercials every 5 minutes. And when I found out about Building 7 in around about 2005, and because the BBC had reported the collapse of Building 7 23 minutes and half an hour before the building actually went down, I decided until they could tell me the original source of that report that I had reasonable cause to believe that there was something wrong. And then there's a law in England, it's called Section 15, Article 3 of the Terrorism Act, that you are forbidden, quite rightly, from funding terrorism or the purposes of terrorism. And it struck me that the BBC was, you know, quite possibly complicit in a cover-up of 9/11, and they refused to tell me the original source. And I don't think anyone in England or America knows the original source for the reports of Building 7 going down before it actually happened. I think the first one, I think if you read David Ray Griffin's book, The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center, the earliest report of that building going down was around about 10:30 in the morning. So very close to the towers going. And so I went to court with the BBC and did relatively well.
Who's normally calling in? People should announce.
Okay.
No, please don't interrupt. We'll get to that in a moment. Please continue, sorry.
Okay, sorry. So I went to court and with quite a good panel of experts, ex-firefighters, ex-police intelligence analysts, ex-counter-terrorist officers from the police force over here who were, you know, awake to the 9/11 problem. And the judge reviewed the evidence. And in any other circumstance, I would have been fined £1,000 because I haven't had a TV license for a long time, 7 years. And he didn't fine me a penny and gave me what's called a conditional discharge, which means to this day I don't have a TV license. I haven't had one since 2007, as I said. And I don't have a conviction for it, so I was basically let off based on the evidence we presented in court. Now, of course, you know, as they do with all this kind of thing, it's propaganda by omission, and they just ignored it. I think it made one national newspaper, and they even misreported that. But because of, getting back to the film, because of the court case, it generated a little bit of publicity within the 9/11 truth movement, and I foolishly said I'd like to make a film featuring nothing but police officers and firefighters, and went on the Alex Jones show, I think it was, and raised not a lot of money, about £2,000 or £3,000. But then one particular guy, who should remain nameless, put in about £25,000. You know, a sort of philanthropic guy over here had a lot of money. And with that, I was able to take a film that really would have been pretty much a patchwork of every other 9/11 film in the world, and able to go to America and interview all these cops and firefighters whose names I'd obtained via Richard Gage, or, well, Andy Steele, actually, at Freeform Radio. But and that's how Perhaps Incontrovertible came about. But it took about 2 years to make, and I had to learn how to use some new film editing software which I'd not dealt with before. So that's why it took a long time. I had to wait a year to get Cynthia McKinney as well, because she was such a busy lady. But I felt, and if you watch the film, it's what it's trying to do is demonstrate that 9/11 is not the only instance where this kind of thing has happened, and it's happened before in with the planning of Operation Northwood. So I was trying to build it up for a police audience, if you like, so they could see that there is an MO, a modus operandi for these people, and that we shouldn't be shocked that 9/11 was an inside job, that this is just really just part of an ongoing pattern. And of course, since 9/11, we've had things like the London bombings, we've had Paris now, and you know, practically every terrorist event, major terrorist event in the world, I think we should be suspicious of. We have, you know, good reason to be suspicious of it. So that's basically the background to the film, Jonathan.
The name of the film, Tony. When did I hit you?
Yeah, I know it's not probably not the smartest name for a film. Well, just you know, talking to Neil Parrott. And
I'm sorry, I need to interrupt you. Whoever's talking in the background, please press *6. *6 will mute your phone. We won't need to hear your background conversation. I apologize.
That's okay. I mean, I knew what the word meant, but talking to people like Neil Parrott and Rudy Dent, I think, mentions it in the film. But I think I came up with the title quite a while ago. I think I even used it in my court evidence on the BBC case, that, you know, the buildings, that the free fall of Building 7 was incontrovertible because it's physics. And when something is comes down, it was born out of a kind of xenophobia as well. You know, how dare these damn Yanks tell us that Isaac Newton is wrong? You know, the greatest British scientist ever, and you know, World Trade Center 7 fell in freefall, and there's only one possible explanation for that. So that's probably where Incontrovertible came from.
Is it Detroit? Is that okay? Is it Detroit?
Yeah. Oh, okay, guys. Background noise.
Yeah, we're getting background buzz here. If you could please mute your phone.
That's all right.
Everyone, *6. If you're not part of this conversation at the moment, *6. Thank you very much for doing that, whoever. *6, thank you. So, Jonathan, do you want to talk about how we can use Tony's incredible film to do outreach there in the United States and what you've been doing with it?
Yeah, it's been loads of fun. I think, you know, if I wasn't so moved by the music in this film, I would feel like it would be another good 9/11 movie, which seemed to have a consensus-building element to it, even while it's touching on critical issues with other false flags and operations and stuff. So it was so sincere and well-produced and the music that I've been inspired to, you know, join with others in New England to have a screening on May 21st, and then together we chipped in. Tony sent 100 copies of his film for $500 that we could get it, and we're going to be asking people to pay $10 for it so we can give away one and they can keep one, or if they want to give it away to a police or fire station, they can get it for $5, and after they watch it, they can pass it forward. But the more people that watch this film, especially people that are, you know, not inclined to deal with it, but they're straight and they're, because when I've entered these police stations, I just walk right in there. I don't make calls or anything and see the receptionist. And I went to the fire station just last Saturday in Greenfield. You get some very interesting responses from people trying to figure out where you're coming from when they see it's a gift and they see that, you know, it was done for police and firemen. They seem to kind of have an interest, and they, it hasn't been turned down by one place, including state police barracks. So all these places, I give it to somebody and I say, look, all I'm asking for, if you watch it with an open mind and consider passing it around the station. And so I would like to see this you know, multiplied in many different areas. And having a screening is a good way of gathering more and more people to do that. And there's so many police and fire stations in every little town that you can just pass. It's just a matter of stopping in there, and it's done well. It's not in-your-face jacket cover. It has a very sophisticated, you know, almost personal jacket cover that, you know, they can just slip in their jacket. It's small. It's cardboard. It's not a lot of plastic. And it seems to have been well-received. So we did get 40 before, and now we're going to get 100. William Woodward is considering doing a screening in around the Portsmouth-Durham era in New Hampshire, and Les has gotten some, and Cheryl, and I think she's already screened it around Hartford. And I'm hoping that it's also distributed among all the community TV stations that Tony's given us permission. But it's one of those movies that you want to watch more than once because it goes into various levels. And that's the best part. It kind of activates your emotions with the sound and with what you're seeing. And so it's a motivating, inspiring film. And not too many people are going to disagree with it because it doesn't touch upon places to argue about. You know, it's just very clear and obvious. I hope other people have seen it. If anybody has, I'd like to hear their thoughts on it.
Okay. Well, we'll should we open it up for comments then?
Great.
Okay.
Just Jonathan is currently my agent, by the way.
Who would like to ask a question or make a comment?
Dick?
I'm sorry?
Craig?
Dick Atley.
Craig?
Dave Schlesinger.
Yeah, Craig.
Dick? Craig, Dick, who else?
Dave Schlesinger.
Dave, who else?
Frank,
who else?
Mike Cook.
Okay, Craig, you're first.
I'm first? I just wanted to ask, I'll leave it to others to ask questions specifically to Tony. I just wanted to know, Tony, if you would be willing to do an interview once I've seen the film. I have a 9/11 blog called Truth and Shadows, and I would really like to do an interview with you and write something about your film, if you're willing to do that.
Yeah. Just drop me an email. Jonathan's got it. That's probably easy just to grab it off him.
Okay.
Yeah, well, go
okay.
Just go to Incontrovertible and you can contact me there. I think incontrovertible911evidence.co.uk. But if you put Incontrovertible, Tony, you'll find the website and you can contact me there and I'll be more than happy to do that. Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
Okay. Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Dick?
I watched the film probably about, two or three weeks ago, and one of the things I was curious about was that there are several places in it where it pretty strongly tells the person, if they're a policeman or a fireman, pretty strongly tells them that they're going to be in trouble if they start talking about this. And then, you know, after the guy in England, the firefighter, ended up being sort of forced out, I just wonder how that goes across when they actually, the people that we give the disc to actually start watching it, whether they were afraid to talk about it with the other people in the department or what goes on with that.
Yeah, I think initially it's right to be concerned and you I can understand how you feel about that, and it was something I thought about when doing it, but in the end, you have to be truthful. There's Brian in the film, the Scottish firefighter who's just quit. There's Tony Farrell, who's an ex-police intelligence analyst in the film, who was sacked for speaking out about 9/11 and the London bombings. But the film's only been out for a little while, so I'm hoping that people will, some firefighters, some police will see it, and it will anger them that they've been treated like this. If they see the film and they react to it positively, just on a factual basis, that then that may anger them. And we've had some success in England. I'll send this in my defence, if you like, at a particular fire station in England. I won't name which one it is yet because I don't want them to get in trouble at this stage. But they're trying to take it to national level now, and they're very angered by what happened to Brian, which was effectively constructive dismissal. They made his life so difficult that he felt he couldn't be himself and be honest anymore at work.
Mm.
but I know for a fact Brian showed it to a colleague of his, and there was about six, I don't know how it works in fire stations in the US, but here, when a guy goes on a watch, you know, a period of time at work, he had about half a dozen guys working with him on any particular watch, and he managed to persuade two or three to actually sit down and watch the film. It's quite a long film, I'll be honest. And one of them took the film home, and his wife, this guy's wife, watched it and said, "You guys have got to go on strike." So there is the argument that, all right, it may scare them, but on the other hand, I think once it gains, or once the knowledge, the perception, the waking up grows just within this small target audience, then they will grow in courage. And hopefully that fear will be overcome, but it needs numbers. Of course, this is only the early stage. I've always been of the opinion that it will, if anything's going to happen, it probably won't happen in America, just because America's just so big. And it may be somewhere like England, because we obviously have the common language. It may happen here, but one of the reasons also being is that firefighters here strike. They do strike. They do refuse to go to work over things. I'm not sure you guys can actually do that there. I think there might be laws against it. It may vary from state to state. But sorry, addressing your question, I think it's early days, and hopefully that fear will be overcome.
Okay.
Okay. Yes. I believe Dale Pierce and John Meadows are in your film. They are the previous team leaders for firefighters and outreach to firefighters and outreach to law enforcement for AE 9/11 Truth. I know John had a list of over 100 names. That was 3 years ago. And Dale had a list. And Richard could give you or whoever a newer list. There's actually a new rule, which means that it's not as likely, but I would like to think that you deserve the exception, or this project deserves the exception. You know, we're not asking people to attend a conference call. You know, people who are working on this could come up with some specific request of actual current and former firefighters and law enforcement to make sure they know about this film. I assume a lot of them do, but some of them may not even know about it and would really appreciate an actual call to notify them. And, you know, I can't see you calling all the way from UK, but I can't imagine we couldn't get other people in the States who can call for free anywhere in the States to use those lists, to ask for the right to use those lists.
Yeah, I mean, I got the list via Richard Gage. I actually got it physically off Andy Steele, who sent it to me for me. Richard said to me, "You'll have to contact Andy Steele. He's kind of in charge of the list. He's growing the list." And Andy sent it to me. This is in 2013, mid 2013. I got the list. And some of them are not verified, and they probably are now. A lot of them were retired. A lot of them are retired. Some of them had a tenuous link to law enforcement. They weren't out-and-out law enforcers. Maybe they worked in a civilian role within the police department or the fire department. But the vast majority were, you know, former cops and former firefighters. And I did call. I remember sitting down for about 2 days in a row just calling all these people. I would have done more interviews in the U.S., but a couple actually just didn't turn up. I did some in New York, and they didn't turn up, which is okay. It's fair enough. And the ones that did were great value. But if you don't have the list, I certainly have no problem in sending it to Jonathan, and so it could be disseminated, and people could call people up there. But I mean, one guy I rang up, I can't remember his name now, but he was like 75 or something. But he'd been a lieutenant and, you know, had a very distinguished police career. And I had no idea. It doesn't give their ages on the list. But there were lots of people who were aware, and I'm sure there's a lot more now.
Well, we should ask Richard and Andy for you folks to be able to have an updated list. And
Well, absolutely. I mean, there were two in the UK. That's the funny thing. Well, I already knew a couple anyway, but the two on the list I had for the UK, one guy was going to do an interview for the film, and then he, I think maybe his wife talked him out of it or something. He changed his mind at the last minute. But you'll get that a lot because you know, like, you know, our previous colleague said, "Oh, are you a bit concerned that they might be scared off?" Well, there's always going to be people who are scared off, always.
Okay. Thank you for the question, Dave. Frank, you're last on the list.
Yes, Frank here. I'd like to compliment you on a film which has excellent production values. I don't want to go and waste time with that. I'm sure you've heard many plaudits from many different people. First question, have you considered making a 58-minute version to show on community television stations here in the United States, which you can, in many cases, in your local community, they will play any film, usually within an hour or 58 minutes, so they can have introductions, etc. Have you considered doing that?
Well, I've been approached by someone in America who said they'll do that. I mean, I'll be brutally frank. If I spent any longer editing, especially Incontrovertible, I'd probably be divorced. So I have to be wary of that. But I've been approached by some people in the States. I think David Cole, David's there somewhere, isn't he? Discussed it with me, and I've somebody says they're going to do it, and if they want to do it, then good luck to them. But I think somewhere in Seattle they were planning on showing it in two parts. We've approached PBS. John Meadows approached PBS in Colorado and asked if they would show the film maybe in two parts. And I do appreciate it. It's a long film. It's not easily digestible. But I personally, just purely for marital reasons, won't be doing a 60-minute edit. But if anybody wants to have a go, they're more than welcome.
Yeah. Well, there's about half a dozen television stations in central New England, Massachusetts, that's playing the whole thing. You know, they just put it on there. And so it's getting some airplay that way, and it's a good way of approaching people that, you know, that aren't coming to your event, and that they're a little bit more, you know, even-minded, and it's a very good tool. But he just did produce a short one, right, for the firefighters. So I think the 9/11 just had a tour with firefighters, with Eric Lawton and Lawyer.
Yeah.
And so I think there should be more of a connection. I've been asking Richard to respond to this campaign and even, you know, DVD and you know, sell it so they, you know, everyone can gain from it. But I haven't heard back from him. I don't know if he gets my emails. But I think there should be some more collaboration with this film.
Okay, well, Richard's in the UK next week, I think.
Good. Well, get him involved.
Frank here. I just have one other quick question. What's the best way to get in touch with you, Tony? I want to discuss some work that a fellow Brit has done in the past and I've been working with. What's the best way to contact you? Killing Anti Films?
Yeah, you can go through the website. If you've got the website address.
And I can leave a message for you there, right?
Yeah, or you can get me in my... Yeah, just go through the website. That's my email address.
The website is linked in our draft agenda for this month, so you can always...
Yeah, Jonathan's got it. Jonathan's got it, yeah.
Okay.
All right, Frank.
Okay.
All right, so we're out of time for this issue. We certainly want to warmly thank Tony for staying up till, what is it, 2 a.m. in Britain. Tony,
I know, I've had to drink several glasses of scotch because of you guys.
Yeah, well, more power to you, and thank you so much. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
No, thanks for letting me
do it. Yep.
And I better go to bed. I will be divorced.
Okay. Good night.
Yeah, good night. Thanks a lot, guys.
Okay.
All the best.
Thanks so much.
Cheers. Bye.
Okay, there have been a few people that joined the call in progress. Could you tell us who you are, please, so that we can list your names on the roll call?
Stick at
Lorenzo.
Okay, one more time.
Lorenzo.
Fine. Got it. I got Dick Atley.
Pat McGuire.
Okay.
Roger Boris, my apologies, I thought I was muted.
Roger Boris, okay. Well, anybody else trying to call recently? Okay, thank you. Is Sheila Casey on the call?
Sounds like she's not. I know she said she would be home from work around 8:30, and not before
8:30. Oh, okay.
So.
Well, why don't we, if there's no objection, we'll postpone that item until Sheila comes on the call, and we'll move along to the next item in the meantime. Okay, that would be me. I've done a short review that I'd like to share of Lance Haven's conspiracy theory in America. So I'll go ahead and give that, and then I'm going to request. Oh, James, you're on the call, aren't you, James?
Yeah.
Chad McGuire, are you on the call?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. Okay, so two people that I asked to take a look at this book also. Hopefully we'll be able to give their comments right afterwards, and then we'll, after I make the proposal. So, okay. Lance DeHaven Smith, by his own admission, was mentored by Mark Crispin Miller. Those of you familiar with Miller's work will find this a helpful portent, and you won't be disappointed. With superbly scholarly flair, but matter-of-fact phraseology, Smith begins his odyssey by grounding the reader in some basic facts of American history and political theory. The Founding Fathers did not trust government, as we are taught to do today. They were relentlessly suspicious of it. Indeed, he asserts, and I quote, "The United States was founded on a conspiracy theory. The founders considered political power a corrupting influence that makes political conspiracies against the people's interests almost inevitable," end quote. Headlining this segment on his segment on conspiracy theory as a flawed and un-American label, he opines after explaining the logical problem with the concept itself, namely that such conspiracies really do occur, and routinely so, that, quote, "This fatal flaw in the conspiracy theory concept makes it all the more surprising that most scholars and journalists have failed to notice that their use of the term to ridicule suspicions of elite political criminality betrays the civic ethos inherited from the nation's founders," end quote. This theme is supported later in the book, but it's heady stuff. In other words, folks, we truthers stand on solid historical ground, whilst the mainstream media and academics does not. He then traces the provenance of the conspiracy theory pejorative label, originating, as most of you know, with the CIA shortly after the Warren Report, and its reincarnations through recent history. Several chapters are devoted to analyzing the psychological impact of this psyop, and you really must read the book yourself to get the full impact. But his study of the way in which the social sciences have been transformed into two wings of conspiracy theory denial is certainly the most scholarly, and as a social science major myself, intriguing foreword of all. He traces these opposing but mutually reinforcing tendencies to Karl Popper, the academic root of modern neoliberalism, whose school of thought dismisses political conspiracy because it's considered feckless, or in other words, ineffective, and Leo Strauss, the father of neoconservatism, which dismisses conspiracy theory because it's likely to be true, and such conspiratorial behavior is a necessary evil of modern government and must be protected. Most fascinating of all is the forerunner, whose work was once predominant in the social sciences, but whom I, as a social science major, had never been exposed to, and that's Charles Beard. He would be dismissed in our times as a conspiracy theorist, or perhaps an economic determinist, but in his heyday, he was taken very seriously. I was so enamored by this introduction to his work that I've ordered several of his classics and have already read The Economic Foundations of Jeffersonian Democracy, which I cannot praise too highly. Back to Smith, he concludes his masterpiece of political science with a proposal to reformulate our understanding of these conspiratorial crimes as, quote, "state crimes against democracy," end quote, to understand that they are a routine evil requiring our vigilance, identification, and prosecution.
and make some practical suggestions on how the criminal justice system needs reform and reinvigoration in order to properly prioritize this paramount task of criminal justice. I believe that this book would serve our teleconference well as a common grounding in political conspiracy and offer us a way to apprehend deep state events in a historically grounded framework and terminology which is more forward-going than the idea of conspiracy theory, the conspiracy theory label that we've been handed by our political opponents. I therefore propose the book for our common reading with the object of reserving liberal space in a future teleconference to discuss its contents. But before we see whether I can get a second for that or not, I think we should hear momentarily from both Kat and James, who have hopefully taken a look at the book as I talk to them. So, Kat, do you have anything to add?
Yes. Regretfully, I have not finished the book, but I would like to say that I was somewhat reluctant to read it. I've had it for a while because, I mean, what more do I need to know? I know about the conspiracy theory meme that the CIA created with the Warren Commission, and we know we're called conspiracy theorists. I mean, how much more is there to say? And I was just really surprised the degree of the depth behind this term beyond what the CIA did with it, and especially I very much appreciated his connection to the founding fathers and that the American Revolution was founded on conspiracy theories about Great Britain, and he talks about our founding fathers in the Constitution. They wrote into it specific clauses that directly address conspiracy theory, and the fact that now we're in complete Orwellian reversal of this, that was just really new to me, and I really appreciated that education. I highly recommend the book, and I'm still enjoying it very much and look forward to finishing it.
Well, thank you, Kat. The reason I asked Kat to be one of the people to take a look at the advanced look at this was because she gave us some pretty heady criticism for the first book that we read in common, that it really didn't provide a thorough grounding for our youth. So I'm encouraged by her enthusiasm. And James, do you have anything to add?
Well, yes, I've read about halfway through it. I'm kind of a slow reader because I chew everything before I swallow it. But I'm very impressed with the thoughtful content, just that he explores a lot of details that I had never thought of or I'd never heard or read of anyone else thinking of or explicating before. A thought that I've been tossing around in my mind lately is that one SCAD that we don't think of is actually the fact that we're supposed to think that democracy is really the ideology by which we operate in America, when for the powers that be and the people that really pull the strings, that's not the way they operate, and so our attempts to operationalize democratic governance and solutions always are frustrated because they keep what's actually going on out of reach of us, and we can't really do much of anything about it. And I would say that the first sort of SCAD sort of umbrella, like an umbrella of all the others, is just inculcating in all of us through the educational system and the media for many decades now that we're supposed to be and operate as a democracy when that is not true. And I think that a lot of what we interpret as, oh, let's say, trickery and concealed false flag events and so forth are really just their modus operandi, just their way of procedure, and that we can't see, that we really can't see the works of what's going on, and so we think we're being tricked all the time when they don't necessarily think of it that way. They just think of it as normal procedure.
Yeah, and of course, the Straussian teaching is to teach us that. I mean, that's for neoconservatism.
Yeah, yeah. Except I don't come down where Strauss does. I think that's a real crime and disservice. And I think most of us really do basically believe in democratic procedure and would like to see that as the way that the country operates.
So, James, can I get a second from you on proposing this as a book for common shared reading and future discussion?
Absolutely.
Thank you. All right, so it's been moved and seconded that we take this book under our wing and give it a common reading. Is there any discussion of the proposal? How many people listening to the three thumbs up reviews here would have an interest in reading the book and discussing it in a future teleconference? Say aye if you would be willing to read the book.
Aye.
Okay. So I think we have enough. As long as there's nobody objecting to this, I think we can then assume that we'll see that those of us that said aye will get the book and read it and. We'll reserve time in a future teleconference, perhaps, what do you think, a month from now? Would that be sufficient time? Speaking of a month from now, I should mention in passing here a very important announcement that the previously scheduled debate for next month has been postponed. We're not sure exactly when it will be rescheduled, but Barbara, because of her new duties as a congressional candidate cannot give the amount of time that she needs to prepare. So we're going to have to wait a little while for that third debate in our series. So next month is open. If there's no objection, then we'll just put it on the agenda for next month to be discussed. And hopefully enough people will let it to make that a fruitful discussion. Okay.
Can I make a suggestion?
Yes, sure.
I wonder if it might not be a good idea for our group to adopt a new purpose in maybe over time compiling a list, a very, very carefully considered list of what we might call our VSBs, which would be a very special book that pertain to our topic, and I would put this one right at the top of the list, and then make that, just sort of publicize that to a wider audience.
Why don't we make it a point to have that as part of our discussion of the book, then, that we consider forming up the VSB list?
Okay, fine.
Okay.
Can I just throw in that it might be of interest that Barry Zwicker is working on an article on this book review for my blog. So that, with any luck, that might be done before next month's meeting, and it might be available for people to consider, or whatnot. So yeah.
Thank you for that. Okay. Okay. So I think we're. I think Sheila's still not with us, right?
Are you there?
Doesn't sound like it.
We can always help. All right. So, with no further ado then, let's move on to the next item. That would be Wayne Fossey. He's going to give us a presentation on his analysis of the Cisco security cameras. Wayne?
Yeah, Ken, thank you so much for the opportunity to kind of go over some of this research that I've got myself involved in and some of the things that I found. This particular issue was initially raised in 2007, shortly after the Judicial Watch was able to receive the videos from Freedom of Information Act requests. And so Up on the, accompanying the agenda, you have the link to a series of, to a PDF that has a series of slides. The presentation will go a whole lot better if you have access to that. And so you can go into the draft agenda in the top part and towards the lower half, see a place where it says this PDF file. And with no further ado, I'd like to just kind of jump in. The slideshow, I'm just going to touch on table of contents, which is slide two. We're going to have an overview. I'm going to go over where CITGO is. I'm not sure if everybody knows exactly kind of where it is and some of the background around it. We're going to talk about the security video itself. We're going to talk about the shadow and the reflected fireball flash that is the centerpiece of this presentation. We're going to talk about some visual impediments because that was one of the stumbling blocks as I've observed it in the past discussions. But I've been able to figure out what the impediments were from some of the photos of the day. Slide three talks about the released videos from the Pentagon. Of course, we know the two security gate camera videos that were released, they include the famous five frames. Of course, there's a source of disagreement about their authenticity and what they really show. The DoubleTree video captures the plane, captures the fireball, but it doesn't show any plane approach or any plane doing anything. It's just not visible or discernible. And then the third one that was released, as far as I know, these are the only three, is the CITGO video. Slide five goes to taking a look at the an overview. This is one of the famous overview pictures. The Citizen Investigation Team used a similar one, or used this one or a version of it to kind of mark where they thought where they had their people kind of mark where they said the plane went. But what it shows is the CITGO is in the very front. There's a grassy area to the left, and a kind of an arc of trees to the left. While it's not particularly relevant, what we're going to see is some photos of the camera crews in the area. The south path, the one that hits the light poles, as shown here, goes to the south side of the CITGO station. That's what I believe, and what I'm going to suggest is actually what's recorded on this video is a picture of the shadows. Slide six shows an overview superimposed on a current day Google map, and what it shows is the south path flight path. It shows where the CITGO station is. It shows that the plane would be about 1,500 feet away. It shows the field of view for the security camera and also kind of the direction of the sunlight. The direction of the sunlight was basically perpendicular to Route 27 as documented in photographs of the day at the time of the impact. Slide 7 is taken on the south side of the CITGO station looking towards the Pentagon on September 11th, and you can see that the building's burning, and the security camera is actually pointed in the opposite direction. Slide 8 is camera crews at the CITGO, and they're actually in that grassy area that was to the left looking, and the photograph is not looking towards the Pentagon, it's looking to the east. Just to give you some background as to what the area looks like. Slide 10, I'm going to get into the security videos, show you what is there. What we see here on the slide 10 is what has been released, effectively. What you see on the top right-hand corner is the dual pump side, and you can see that there's a car sitting in a pump. That's where Sergeant Lagasse is fueling up his vehicle, and that's where he was when he saw the plane approach. That's in the upper top right-hand corner. On the left-hand side, there's a series of four squares. The one of those four squares, the bottom left, is the a single pump side, and that's where you'll see the shadow. As a matter of fact, there's two little blurs there that are the shadow. You can see that they're separated. I will go over those in just a little more detail a little bit later. Slide 11 talks about or shows that during the post-impact or something happens, and what we see is that there's I've circled the area where you can actually see people gathering, going to the doors, and then going outside the doors immediately after what I call the reflective fireball flash. Slide 12 is the CITCO is showing the single pump side, and this one here I'm going to stop and pause a little bit. In the single pump side, what you see here is a car pulled up to the gas pump. It's a blur in that single pump side to the right, and just above it you see two dark kind of dashes with a white with nothing in the middle. And if you actually look at the videos, these things just kind of appear and gone. All throughout the video before this, you'll see cars going back and forth across it. And in the appendix, I've highlighted where you can see cars and where the lower parts of the cars and where you can't see them, trying to get an understanding of what the vegetation might have been, the obstructions, things like that. So this is the CITCO video. And that's what we're going to be taking a look at. Now, if we go to slide 14, where we can look at the, we're going to look at these images just a little more focused here. Slide 14 shows the single pump side kind of superimposed or brought into the larger video, so we can see them all time synchronized. And you can see where Sergeant Lagasse is. He's to the car side of the pump. You can actually see him moving around during during the actual videos. The going on to slide 15, we've highlighted where the shadows are. Again, slide 16 shows the reflective fireball flash. The ceiling of the CITCO station shows a series of flashes, or shows a flash, and that's the most dramatic one, highlighted in red there. But there are two others. So there's a total of three things that kind of light up on this particular slide that you don't see previous in the others, and they disappear in the next frame, which the frames are one-third of a second. And so there's the one that's highlighted is flash. There's one between the legs of an A to the left of that, and then on the single pump side, it's much fainter, but it is discernible that there is some sort of a flash, or it appears to be a flash there. Moving on to slide 17, we can estimate that it's possible to estimate the speed of a plane by taking a look at the difference between when the shadow appears and when the fireball flash is observed. We don't know exactly. First of all, there's a third of a second error on either side of all these measurements. We don't know how long it would take a fireball to grow and expand and create the flash that would have been recorded. But if you go to slide 18, what you can see is that given the fact that there was 3 seconds between the fireball flash or the shadow and the fireball flash, allowing a half a second for evolution of the fireball to where it flashed and caught, what we see is that the speed of the plane would be someplace on the order of 450 to 530 miles an hour, but it looks like it's on the lower side. Slide 19 asks the question, could the reflective fireball flash be something else? And, of course, the answer to that is yes, it could be. But as I pointed out, other evidence suggests that something happened at approximately the time of the reflective fireball flash. Sergeant Lagasse leaves within 15 seconds of the flash. Customers in the store gather at the door and rush out, so something happens at about that time. And it's not unreasonable, not proven, not unreasonable, that the reflective fireball flash is, in fact, the reflective fireball flash.
I'll just talk about them in general. Slides 21 to 23 are slides showing where vegetation is, and you can see that there are impediments to having seen the shadow. The top left, the slide 21 shows right near the 11s, just to the right of it, you'll see some trees, bushes that are growing. Slide 22 shows that there's a lot of vegetation in front of the Citro station. And slide 23 actually is kind of the thing that I was most surprised to find. If you go to Google Maps, you can actually go back to historical Google Street View maps. And June 2008, what we see is those two trees have grown up to be even bigger. And so they were there on September 11th. They were there in 2008. They were to being able to see the entire shadow. I'll conclude with noting that on the slide after where it says questions, there's a link to the 9/11 Truth Outreach website where we've got an article that goes through the same amount of material here. And I think that concludes my talk, and I'll answer any questions to the best of my ability. Thanks.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, a couple of things. The first thing that struck me when I saw this article, I mean, the headline of your article on the 9/11 Truth Outreach website is Pentagon Plane Approach Captured on Video. Well, this is stating this as if it's an established fact, when in fact it's really just speculation. The so-called shadow, I mean, I haven't found anybody yet who looks at that and thinks it's an airplane. It looks to me more like some sort of digital glitch. But in any case, it's far from established that it's an airplane. So I think you should change the headline on your story to reflect that, frankly. Also, the fireball, I mean, you're saying that the fireball was half a second long. I mean, there's clearly a bright light that comes on the video at some point. But it's very brief. And I can't imagine how a fireball, you know, where thousands of gallons of jet fuel are exploding, would come and go that fast. So I think, and again, in your presentation, you refer to it as a fireball flash, as if, and then, you know, and as if that's established, which it also isn't. So I would love it if you'd comment on those.
Yeah, well, I'd like to cue also is Lorenzo.
Okay, Lorenzo,
well,
go ahead.
Yeah. First of all, as far as the title goes, you know, I actually think it's a pretty accurate. And that's why I'm here defending this, or defending it, or introducing it, and taking questions. As far as the very breadth, the brief, the brevity. Remember, I refer to this not as the fireball, but the reflected fireball flash. And what we have, I believe, if you've read the article, or what's in the article, I should say, what you'll see is that there is a police car, or there's a car at the corner that is the source of the reflection. And it moves away, at that time. And so, it appears that there are, in fact, it's not a recording of the fireball as if it were a mirror. It's a reflection off of two or three things moving. And the two things that are the most visibly moving is a car going across from west to east that lights up between the legs of the A in that video frame, and the car on the right hand side that where the reflection occurs. And so that explains to me, to my satisfaction, that these are in fact reflections of something. And because there are multiple ones that light up in this particular frame and only this particular frame, it seems as if they are in fact a very reasonable hypothesis that they are the reflection of the fireball. And as I said, it could be something else, but congruent or time synchronized with this is Lagasse is
packs up and leaves within 15 seconds, which is in accordance with what his recorded statements have been, and the people inside the convenience store begin to gather at the door and go out to look. So something happened then, and it seems like it's a very reasonable expectation that it was capturing the fireball.
But the shadow is just a hypothesis as well, is it not? I mean, you don't know that for certain. You're speculating that that's what that was.
I think that it is very reasonable. I mean, what we've done is we've looked at this. If you actually look at the videos, what you're going to see is you're going to see cars going back and forth, and, you know, some kind of cars are going to be black, and then some are going to be white, and then going east, and they're going west. And if you actually look at them, they have a very particular behavior. They move from one side to the other, and there are certain spots where they're not visible, or portions of the cars aren't visible, and you'll see that in the appendix. These particular dual black spots appear simultaneously across what is at least 40, if not a much larger visual space, 40 feet, and they are there in one frame and they're gone, and there's nothing else like that in the videos, suggesting that it is something very different. And because the observation of many witnesses are that a plane flew over the south side of the Citgo station.
That's not true.
We don't want to get into too much controversy.
Yeah, I understand. Okay. Somebody has a conversation going on in the background. If you could mute your phone, please, *6, that'd be helpful. Okay.
There are many witnesses that say a plane went by the south side of the Citgo station. This is, and because the shadow is there, it suggests that that is, in fact, a supportive evidence. And so we'll go to the next question. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure Craig would love to repeat that.
I would love to, yes, but I won't.
Okay. Barbara, you're next.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, good. Thank you. Okay. Well, I want to second everything that Craig said. There's no question in my mind that this is a hypothesis and a very weak one based upon the visual resolution. I'd also like to point out that in the actual article on the 2000 website, there's actually a subhead, "Are these dark marks a shadow or something else?" I mean, Wayne, as the author, is actually putting the question, it's obviously a hypothesis, that he believes is true. And the title is definitely way overstated. But I would also like to point out that under that very headline, "Are these dark marks?" They're actually so-called dual bars. Kind of strange that a plane would have a shadow that was dual bars. But anyway, the subhead says, "Are these dark marks a shadow or something else? Question mark." Right under that is a screen capture from a Citgo video. And if you notice, the date is 1/1/93. Now, I read that as January 1st, 1993, not 2001. So I would ask, why is any of these security videos are going to have date and time stamps? So that appears to be the date stamp. So has somebody gone back into the past and found something that fairly fits the official story of 9/11? I'd also like to point out that Wayne did make a misstatement in his opening summary when he said that he wasn't aware, I can't believe he isn't aware of the DoubleTree Hotel video. He said that there were only the two security cam videos from outside the Pentagon and the Citgo video. That's not correct. There's also an extremely important DoubleTree Hotel video. I'd also like to point out that even if this is, the Citgo video is from 9/11, which is a great question because of the date and time stamp, on the video itself, even the screen capture that Wayne has in his own article on Truth House website, I would point out that the time is way off. It's not anywhere close to 9:37 and 45 or 46 seconds, which is the official story time based upon the alleged FDR, allegedly found inside the rubble, which we know wasn't even from the right kind of FDR, according to American Airlines' own press release right after it was allegedly discovered on early in the morning on September 14th, 2001. So anyway, I could go on and on, but I definitely second everything that Craig said, and I've added what I just said here. Thank you.
Wayne, you want to comment on the timestamp?
Well, first of all, I'm baffled about the comment about 1993. You know, the...
Take a look at your own article.
Yes. Now, there is a timestamp on this that is elsewhere that has the September 11th, 2001, and it's got the time 9:40:35, I believe. So, I mean, there are many things on this, but there is the timestamp. If you actually go and watch the video, you can actually see the timestamp moving as it progresses through time.
Well, not on the screen capture that you put in your article.
Well, so I'm going to encourage you, Barbara, to actually go take the time and go look at the video.
I've looked at it many times. I've looked at it many times, Wayne.
Okay.
I would just ask you, why did you choose this particular screen capture then?
Because this is what they all look like. They all have this particular look to them. So, and the date on there is September 11th, 2001, and the time is 9:40. I don't know what else to say. Now, was there something else you went on to?
Okay, well, let's not go here. People can go to the website.
Not on this screen capture in your article. I refer people to the article.
Yeah, people should go to the article on the 9/11 Truth Outreach and see for themselves what the timestamp says. Okay, let's move on to Dick. Dick Marble.
I just wanted to say that I'm on the call. This is Sheila.
Oh, hi, Sheila. Well, not a moment too soon. Okay. We have to use this up next. Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
It seems that the use of the word fireball flash may not be helpful here, because when you actually look at the supposed frames of the two videos that the FBI released, there's a white flash, which isn't part of the fireball. It happens first. I think Barbara deals with this in her film also. There's a red fireball that occurs sort of on the tail of it, and is there after that white flash has disappeared. And that may be what's showing up in the Sitco station, if there is a connection. But I don't see why one has to assume that that's a shadow of a plane. The fireball, the flash occurred. I mean, there's no question about that, and that shows up in the video. So whether one can then say that by taking a certain number of seconds earlier, you can conclude that the shadow is a plane, is another matter, and I'm afraid I'm not convinced of that.
Okay. Thank you for the comment. And last, Lorenzo.
Can I respond? Actually, this is probably going back to Barbara's because we've got sidetracked on the timestamp. Let's just say that if you go take a look above where it says Sunday SN800, you're going to see in the video, you're going to see the timestamp, and it's going to show nine. It's going to show you the time nine, whatever it is, 36, and the one I'm looking at, and then it's got the date 9/11/01. There is other stuff to the left, but the thing that is moving as you watch the video is the timestamp that is right above the place where it says SUNA00. Now, I also need to address the other issue, because you kind of flew by me here, so to speak, the split, the shadow, how a plane can show up in two spots. The reason this started being discussed in 2007 then appears to have kind of died out is no one could explain why there were two separate separated marks. First of all, the black and white camera is recording the tree as white, and you can see that by looking at the cars going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And we've shown that there's a tree there, and we show that there is a reason that you will not be able to see the shadow on both sides of that tree if the tree is shown white, and that explains why there are two different pieces of it that are shown. And sorry, I didn't get to that in direct response to Barbara. Okay, next question, please.
Okay, finally, last Lorenzo.
All right, this has to do with interpretation and semantics at this point. There's a lot of stuff that is very much interpretation. I can't get into any opinions about what may be or not. But there is one particular description, and fireball generally goes with a fuel fireball, but flash would be explosive, and kerosene or jet fuel is not really explosive as bright as that. So that pretty much cuts out the idea that there would have been any jet fuel ignited at that point. It pretty much leaves an explosive flash, which for a brief moment there was this bright glow around it, and then there was no black smoke. The second or third frame, it was gray or beige and very dissipated smoke. No sign whatsoever of a kerosene fire. So I would venture to say that just flash would have been more than sufficient to describe what happened.
Thanks, Lorenzo. But what I was pointing out, and I thought I had mentioned several times, is that this is in fact a reflected fireball flash, a reflection off a car. And
reflection,
if you take a look,
flash, there's no fireball.
Right. That's your assessment, right? So let me just point to slide 16, which is the video that we wanted to take a look at, or which is where you see the flash. And what's happening is there's a car on the left hand or right below that that is creating this particular flash.
I have no argument with the timing.
Your point, as I understood it, was that the flash, that a fireball would last much longer, this had to be something else. But this vehicle that is doing this flash, you can see it drive away. So it is...
I'm not arguing with you.
Okay. Well, let's just finish then. So it is the vehicle is driving away, and as it's driving away, or it is parked, there's a reflection, and it lasts one video frame, which is one-third of a second, and that's what's captured. You need to clarify what you said. I'm not sure that we're in agreement, but...
very much accurate description.
Pardon?
Very much in agreement, except for the term fireball.
You're right. There is something that's happened at just about this time that's going to cause Sergeant Lagasse to leave. It's causing people inside the building to gather out the doors and look out. And so something has happened, and it seems that the thing that is lighting up the roof of the Pico and the other items that are highlighted in slide 16 are related to that event that has just happened. And so it seems reasonable, because the camera's not directed towards the Pentagon but away from it, that these are in fact reflections of something that is in the back, behind
it. Very interesting analysis. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your question, Lorenzo, and Wayne, thank you for your presentation. We're out of time on this issue now, so let's move on to our last item on the agenda, which will be the review of "And Nobody Died in Boston Either" from both of our contributors from the World Conference here, Sheila Casey and Craig McKee, both of whom contributed chapters to this book, edited by Jim Fetzer. So, which of you is going to go first?
Sheila, do you have a go first?
Because Craig's going to kind of give an overview, and I'll talk about my article.
Okay.
Chapter.
Yeah. It'll be a brief overview, because I haven't really read the book, so I can sort of give you the gist of what's in it. I've kind of skimmed some of the other chapters. I mean, I can tell you basically that there are a number of contributors that probably are people might recognize, including, well, besides Jim Fetzer, there's also Paul Craig Roberts has a chapter in it. James Tracy has a couple of chapters. There's different ones. There's ones that talk about, Tracy talks about the training exercise, and also the subject of crisis actors, which Sheila's going to tell you about. Fetzer talks about the backpacks, the fact that the backpacks that, in particular, Jahar Tsarnaev was wearing is absolutely not the same one that exploded. And he also talks about the demonization of Muslims and also Russia in the narrative. Anyway, there are other people, Sterling Harwood, Alan William Powell. Powell goes into the crisis actor thing too. I'm not sure I totally agree with everything that he deals with, but anyway, there are different elements of it covered. My chapter was kind of an overview of what I thought didn't make sense about the case against the brothers. I mean, I believe that the brothers, there's absolutely no proof that the brothers are guilty. I mean, there is a confession, but there are a lot of oddities even about that confession. I mean, it started off, the trial started of Jahar Tsarnaev started off with their lawyer, after they had pled not guilty. Judy Clark, the lawyer, basically tells the jury that he, in fact, is guilty. And not only did she give up basically on that first day, but she didn't even cross-examine most of the 92 prosecution witnesses, and she only called four of her own. The entire defense took 5 hours, which is just incredible. And all of this supposedly because she was trying to keep him from suffering the death penalty, and that didn't work at all. Anyway, I quote Russ Baker in my piece, and just to give an idea of how thin the case is against the brothers, he writes, without the murder of the MIT policeman, followed by the carjacking confession reported by this person who was identified as Danny, we would have no solved crime, no evidence linking anyone to the horrific Boston Marathon bombing except some grainy video of two guys wearing backpacks in a sea of other backpack wearers near the source of the explosion. The assumption many of us make that the Tsarnaevs planted these bombs is just that, an assumption that in the absence of the reported confession has no evidence behind it. And, you know, one thing I sort of look at in some detail is just the whole story of how they attempted to escape, and how the story of them attempting to escape just absolutely defies reason. I mean, the brothers had seemingly gotten away with the crime until they took a series of inexplicable actions. These events started 3 days after the bombing, when police released photos of the brothers and asked the public for help in identifying them. They were labeled as suspects at this point. And yet, it's interesting that the only reason that the photo of the younger brother was even identified was because allegedly Jeff Bauman, who was the guy who supposedly had his two legs blown off, he supposedly saw Jahar put the backpack down. But in the video that was released to the public, you see the two brothers walking kind of one behind the other with some distance between them. So I'm not entirely sure how they managed to figure out who Tamerlan, the other brother, was, if all they had to go on was one person seeing this one brother and telling people, telling journalists that he thought he looked out of place, which is a kind of a weird thing to conclude about somebody when you're at a public event with thousands of people and you look at one guy for a couple of seconds and you think he looks out of place. And there's a very strange sequence of events where they carjack, the two brothers are in a vehicle, they carjack somebody else's vehicle and take them hostage, with now one of them driving each vehicle, and then they let the guy escape, basically. They go and supposedly shoot an MIT policeman to get his gun, even though they already supposedly had a gun. And then they don't even take the MIT policeman's gun anyway. So all of this makes no sense. They drive off in the stolen car, which of course then is what ends up getting them caught. And of course we also have the confession, supposedly, that Jahar wrote on the inside of the boat where he was hiding. He somehow managed to find a pen inside the boat. One assumes it was a felt pen of some kind, so that you could write on the side of a boat hole with it. And, of course, it made the connection to the, it connected the whole narrative to the Muslim idea that this bombing was done as a retaliation for the killing of Muslims by the United States. So, I mean, what all this led to? I wanted to mention, too, the Boston Globe reported that there was, 2 months later, there was going to be an exercise called Operation Urban Shield that was going to focus on a terrorist group using a skull logo, which is actually just what we saw on that day. It was a group that is people believe is Kraft International, a CIA-linked security company, with that logo. The exercise would have them dropping off bombs in backpacks at various locations in Boston. So that was going to happen in June of 2013. And let's see here. Oh, yeah, the other thing, too, that's very bizarre is that in the note that the younger brother wrote, he says, "I don't mourn my brother because he is a martyr in paradise, where I expect to be soon." But reportedly, when he woke up in the hospital, the first thing he asked was how his brother was. So that's kind of a bizarre contradiction. If he already knew he was dead, why would he ask that question? And then there's a whole thing, which I won't get into because I guess time is relatively short, and I want to give Sheila some time there. But there's the whole connection of the brother's uncle, who was married to the daughter of a senior CIA official, former CIA station chief in Kabul. And he's somebody who's very, very involved, basically, in the whole, in that whole region where they came from. So that just the fact that there's that CIA connection is kind of so typical of these things, that there's some connection to the intelligence community. And we also know that the FBI was surveilling the older brother for years, literally. So finally, I'll just finish off with this. When you add up the bomb exercise, the presence of what appeared to be Kraft International contractors, the abundant evidence of faked injuries, the inconsistent and improbable carjacking story, as well as the murder of Sean Collier, the MIT cop, you get a picture of a deception, a staged bombing, a false flag operation. This doesn't mean that no one was injured or killed. I think that's something the book takes the strong position that nobody was killed, and I think you can make a strong case for that. But we know that things did not happen the way we were told, and we know that this young guy basically got railroaded and did not get his fair day in court. So I'll stop there and let Sheila talk about her chapter.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay, thanks, Craig. What I'd like to do is, since my article is essentially, or my article chapter is essentially an analysis of the videos and photos from the first bomb, for those of you who are at your computer, I'd like you to actually go to the site, and I'll be referencing these photos. And this is Craig's site, truthandshadows.wordpress.com. Are many of you at your computers? I kind of assume people are. Maybe I'm wrong. How many people are at their computers? Can I just hear an eye? Okay. Well, so if you go to truthandshadows.wordpress.com and then go over to the right-hand column under posts, this article is currently second from the bottom. Called False Flag Theater, Boston Bombing Involves Clearly Staged Carnage. So I'll just start in. What is that noise?
Well, can everybody please star 6 your phone? There's some real bad background noise, and we need to try. Thank you. Star 6.
And if you want to get back into the conversation at any point, just star 6 again. We'll bring you back. I'm sorry, Sheila. Go ahead.
Okay, no problem. So I spent... Oh, I'm still hearing that noise.
Yeah.
But I'll just keep talking. What is that?
I would say that NSA or CIA Assad interference.
Gotten it better, doing a better job by now.
Thank you.
Okay.
I don't see what you're telling me to look for over on the right side.
Okay, if you go over to the right side and scroll down to where it says top posts, then there are a list of these are the posts that are getting the most traffic. Look for the second to the bottom post under top posts. It's false flag theater. Boston bombing involves clearly staged carnage.
I think it's third. I think it's third from the bottom now, Sheila.
Mm. Oh, is it? Okay. Well, maybe because people are clicking on it.
It's coming up.
So, if you're on that page, I'll just start at the top. We used this one as the initial image in the article because it's just so ridiculous that this man would be lying there having... theoretically, have both his legs blown off at the knee, and yet he's not being attended to. As the caption says, everyone ignores the man who just lost his legs. This, my piece is much easier to understand on Craig's blog than it is in the book, because I searched the internet to find the highest resolution photos for each of these photos. So almost all of them, if you click on them, you'll get the high-res photo. My conclusion was, after looking at the video and going through the photos, and because many of the videos were time-stamped, I was able to kind of put things into a chronology. For example, the famous photo of Jeff Bauman being wheeled away, I know is at least 7 minutes after the bomb went off, the so-called bomb. Probably more than that, although I can't say for sure how much more. And that particular photo is probably the smoking gun about this staged event, because he supposedly had both legs blown off at the knee or below the knee, and yet it's now been at least seven minutes. He has not had medical attention. He does not have an applied tourniquet on his leg. One tourniquet is caught under the wheel. One of them is sort of resting on his leg, but not actually winched or tightened. And you're wondering, why is this man not in an ambulance? Why was he not the first one to be whisked into an ambulance and off to a trauma center? Instead, he was left lying for at least 7 minutes while other people who were not injured were put onto gurneys and wheeled away. And then when they do wheel him away, they don't put him on a gurney. The protocol for a traumatic amputation of the leg is to lie the victim on their back. I'm just going to keep talking over the noise since apparently nobody...
Yeah, I'm sorry, Sheila.
Can anybody mute their phone who's... Or maybe it's the NSA, well, who knows. The protocol is to lie the victim on their back and elevate the limb, because obviously to prevent bleed out, to use gravity to prevent bleed out. According to Wikipedia, you can die of a severed femoral artery within 3 minutes. The femoral artery is only in the thigh. It's the same artery continues on down through the knee and into the calf, but then it just goes by a different name because the femur is above the knee. So If it was actually severed below the knee, it's not actually called the femoral artery, but still has massive blood flow. The idea that he could have both legs severed and be wheeled away 7 minutes later, not leaving any kind of blood trail on the pavement, not being put into an ambulance, and being sitting up conscious and holding his own leg up, It's just absurd and defies any kind of medical protocol for these kinds of situations.
There's definitely background conversation. I have to ask everybody to please mute your lines. Star 6.
Star 6, please, everybody. You've got to get rid of that background noise. Star 6. And then if you need to get back at Star 6 again, okay. Star 6, please.
That seemed to help.
I think it's helping. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So, you know, if you're on the, I hope people have been able to find the page and know the photo that I'm looking at. You can click on it to get a high-res version, which takes up, you know, most of my computer screen. And another interesting thing is that his leg looks very different than it does. His legs look very different than they did when he was lying on the ground a few minutes ago. Apparently, they've attached a prosthesis of some kind and made it look a little more authentic than what they originally had on there. But yet we can see that his left leg, certainly, still has the knee intact. And yet, if you scroll down a little bit, you can see the photo of him when he made his appearance at the Bruins hockey game. And now they have amputated both legs above the knee. And this is just 3 weeks later, the idea that he'd be out and about now, you know, looking joyful, having just lost his legs. It's ridiculous. And there would be no reason why, if somebody's knees were still intact, that they would amputate above the knee. Another thing that just makes no sense. So this entire story is... This entire story is ridiculous. There are so many ways in which it just does not add up, does not make sense, and what we're told clearly just did not happen. When the so-called bomb went off, we know from watching the video, most of the runners kept going. Many of the runners thought that it was some part of the finish line festivities because it wasn't really a bomb. It was just smoke. And nothing around there was damaged. Not any of the wood, the balsa wood that was holding up the fence, not the flags, not the runners. Not a single runner was injured. And, you know, doesn't that seem interesting that not a single runner was injured? And I'm thinking, well, why would that be? Because it would be very complicated and difficult to have a crisis actor actually to find one who was a marathoner and then could time their run 26 miles and time it to be there at the right moment. That would be very difficult to arrange. So probably that's the reason why there's not a single claim of an injured runner, although they're saying there's 264 people who were injured. So maybe I will just read my closing kind of summary here from my article, because this is the question that I get from people all the time. It's like, why would they bother to do this? Why would they bother to fake it when, you know, these people have no conscience? Why wouldn't they just go ahead and kill people? Wouldn't that be easier? Well, I really don't think so. I think the reason they did it was, and I will just read what I wrote here to make it easy. The government has staged many terror attacks to achieve political goals, and they no doubt learned that one of their biggest headaches after such an attack was the grieving family members who kept pointing out the inconsistencies in the stories they were given about how their loved ones had died. For the citizen mindlessly ingesting standard news pabulum, the official story may seem plausible. Not so for the highly motivated mother, husband, or daughter of a victim who latches on like a bulldog and won't let go until they get the answers they seek. But the perpetrators still need graphic images of human suffering to incite the kind of rage that prompts the citizenry to willingly surrender their rights and let the feds ignore the law and do as they please. The solution was evidently to stage terror attacks with actors, where no one actually gets hurt. In the case of the Boston Marathon bombing, they were able to achieve all the same goals that a real terror attack would have, such as testing whether it's possible to close down a city over a single teenage so-called terrorist on the loose, without the nuisance of grieving, inquisitive family members. And I think another thing I'd like to add to that is that because these were paid actors, essentially they were temporary workers hired just to do a job, they're able to use these photos of people that under normal circumstances I think would be a violation of privacy. I don't think most people, I think it would be considered a violation of privacy for most people to be photographed in their, you know, in their moment of trauma, lying in their own blood somewhere. And yet, in this case, they have a total right to use whatever they want. And they can, of course, shape the story. They can always make it sound like whoever was injured was some kind of a saint, and we always hear that as well. They were saintly individuals, and then they, of course, demonize people like the Tsarinevs, make it sound as though they're, you know, straight out of the bowels of hell, because they're trying to drum up outrage and trying to get, you know, again, demonizing Muslims and getting people to cooperate with, you know, gross violation of their Fourth Amendment rights in simply walking into their homes and ordering them at gunpoint down the stairs so they could, you know, use their homes for outposts. There's a lot more I could say about this. I don't know how we're going with our time right now, but one more photo I'd definitely like to point out is, let's see, how can I describe where this one is? It's if you go all the way to the bottom, it'd be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It would be the ninth one up from the ninth image up from the bottom, including the image of the actor waiver form from the Homeland Security website. And here we see Jeff Bauman's severed leg, supposedly, directly over this woman's head. Now, he has yet to have any medical attention. She's wearing a white blouse, and yet there is no blood. There is no blood in her hair. He would be gushing blood. He had just had his leg blown off. Someone else pointed out that these bombs were very selective in the kind of damage they did. In many cases, we'd see people with ripped and shredded clothing, but the flesh underneath had not been harmed. Also, it blew off a lot of legs, but people were not injured in any other way. We never saw anybody, for example, with an ear blown off or a gaping hole in their stomach from this so-called bomb. So it's again something that it just doesn't make any sense. I think the most astonishing thing about it is how careless they are. It really seems to me like how does that expression go? Thumbing their noses in our face. because they know people like me are going to sit here and analyze it and see how ridiculous it all is. And I'm maybe write an article about it. And this article has been widely read. It was first posted on Veterans Today and then taken down inexplicably, and it's been on Craig's website for 3 years, and it's had a total of about 200,000 views between those two sites. So that is a lot of people, but it's not enough to make any real difference in, in actually changing. You know, it's still a very small percentage of the total population. So to me, it just seems really sad that they can do something that's so ridiculous, that makes so little sense, and yet is believed and taken at face value by so many people as just the story that they see on CNN. And yet they keep doing it. I guess that's all I have to say.
Okay.
I don't know how we are in our time.
Yeah, well, actually, we're out of time, but we maybe should take say 5 more minutes to give people an opportunity to ask questions. If you have any quick questions for Craig or Sheila, you have to keep it very quick. Who wants to be on the stage?
Dave Schlesinger.
Frank Bradbury.
I'm sorry?
Lynn Bradbury.
Lynn? Frank? Who else?
Frank? Kat McGuire.
Kat? Who else? Okay, Dave, you're first. Keep it very short, please.
Yes. I just want to say I'm very concerned about this. I lived in Boston so many years, and I made some attempt to have a panel for the Left Forum this year, which we didn't pull together, so I'm very much hoping people can be in touch with me in the hopes of having a panel for the Left Forum next year. And I did keep contact with Jack Graham, who was on this call several months ago, about the Boston bombing, and he says that Zokar's aunt, who is a lawyer, does not believe that the person who pleaded guilty is her nephew.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, I heard that, too.
Okay. Lynn, you're next.
So if they hired actors, they hired a paraplegic actor, maybe, because you can't see his real legs in these photos.
Oh, yeah, they hire amputees.
Yeah.
They hire people who had their limbs amputated, you know, at some previous time. Who knows, maybe 10, 15 years ago. And if you, I talk about that in the article, that that this is something that the military is known to do, that they use amputees. If you scroll down to the very bottom, there's a screenshot there from a CNN video, Amputees Act in War Schools. And the link to the actual video is just above the image, is the image of a makeup artist making it look like somebody has blood on their existing stump.
And so in other photos, not here, but in other photos of, you know, horrible scenes, is there a different color shade to the blood than in this picture that does look like paint? Have they been compared?
Well, I'm not sure which picture you're looking at, but
both of two or three different ones.
Well, yes, that's right. I think the blood
looks like
ridiculous.
My
honestly,
first impression of the first photo was it looks very bright.
Liz,
look at the photo of the hockey player that got his from the stroke.
Jugular.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Look at that one. It gets you a contract.
I know, and that's on ice. That presumably that's on ice, so it's on the right. I know how dark it looks.
The problem with blood color is that it changes color over time. As it loses its oxygen, it starts out bright red, and then it darkens down to mud.
Well, that guy who got cut quickly with his jugular, that can't have happened too long before.
No, you wouldn't think so.
No, he was it was just a minute or so that he was on the ice before he was getting help, or maybe even less.
Maybe.
This is Rich O'Coin in Massachusetts. I have an observation and a question that I have for the FBI that I don't believe has ever been answered. The observation first is, there was much puzzlement here in Boston when Shahar did admit guilt because he spoke with a thick Russian accent, which no one expected. So that corroborates the idea that it wasn't, in fact, him. Also, my question to the FBI is, how did you know, before you even encountered the brothers on Friday, that there were no other conspirators? You got on TV and told us, any evidence we have, we don't want to see any pictures that you have that aren't these two people, number one and number two, we don't want to see. Well, how did they know there were no other conspirators at that time, before they even knew the identities of their suspects?
Yeah, good point. Okay.
Did you say who had the thick Russian accent?
Jahar had a thick Russian accent in court. It happened more than once. It happened more than once, and it was kind of a puzzlement to the media personalities discussing it. They weren't questioning his identity, but they were saying it's weird that he talked to the thick Russian accent. It's all Googleable. You can all look this up. He had this thick Russian accent. In fact, I talked to Russ Baker about it, and he said he would put somebody on that to investigate it. I haven't heard anything more, but I do believe that's an important point that's being completely overlooked here.
I think, too, that if I'm not mistaken, it was his aunt who said that she didn't believe it made any sense that the confession, because he talks all the way through. He actually mentions Allah 16 times in his I wrote this in the article. 16 times he mentions Allah, God 4 times, creation 4 times, blessings 4 times, and the Prophet Muhammad 3 times. All of this, you know, in this fairly brief confession. And his aunt, I believe, is on record as saying that that's not something he would ever say.
Well, the confession in the boat was very convenient
of the government because it came, it was found, so-called, a month after the incident of
right.
the boat. And yes, it, was
absolutely.
It was after talk of his constitutional rights having been violated when he was illegally interrogated in the hospital, and anything he said is not going to stand up in court. Well, the confession, so-called, solved that problem because he wrote that before that interrogation occurred.
Yeah, just to be clear, when I was talking about the confession, I meant the one in court, but you're quite right about what you've just said, but I mentioned what I was saying was in court when he read that.
Oh,
confession.
Well, that was with the thick Russian
okay.
accent.
Yeah. Thank you for
right.
Ken,
it's Barbara. I wanted to be on the chat, but I forgot to unmute.
Okay, Barbara, I'll put you at the end. Kat, you're next. Go ahead.
Yes. I don't understand how, like, one of the crisis actors, like Jeff Bauman, don't people who know him in real life, from wherever he is, and aren't they saying, hey, that's Jeff, the guy that we know. I mean, where's the family? Where are the people who know him in real life? Is Jeff Bauman his name as the victim or his real actor name? I guess it's his victim name. But where are the people who know him as an actual actor person?
Can I take that one, Craig?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the way I think it works is that his name is not Jeff Bauman, and actually I think there might be multiple actors working here, because I think the man, he's in the wheelchair that we see in the iconic photo is a different than the one that we're seeing later being pushed out on the ice. The one that's being pushed out on the ice, to me, looks much younger. And so they have, in some cases, multiple people who are playing Jeff Bauman. And Jeff Bauman is just a made-up name. Typically, the family will very much be soft-pedaled. There won't be photos of them. So it's somebody who was hired, somebody who could be named, anything. And he was hired to do this job, and he gets paid, and he goes on with his life. And I think that that's one reason. So no, there's nobody saying, oh, I know Jeff Bauman. And there may be people who say, well, that looks a lot like an amputee guy that I know named, Bob Cook or whatever. But how many people are really going to think that it is Bob Cook? Because we can all look so different in photographs. I can look like a completely different person depending how, the lighting, and that's true about all of us. So I think that they, they just, for one, they go with people's gullibility, that people are just going to assume that, yes, that is somebody named Jeff Bauman who worked at a Costco. And they make up a story for them. And there is no Jeff Bauman.
Well, wouldn't the people at Costco say, wait, we don't know who this person is?
They never identified the Costco. They just say a Costco. So they often will be vague enough. They might say where somebody lives, but they don't give an address. And think about it. If you heard in your town that somebody who lived on your street had died, so-and-so had been in some kind of an incident, and you had never heard of that person, you wouldn't say, oh, that person must not exist. You would just say, I guess I never met him, or I guess I never, bumped into him, or, you would simply assume that you didn't meet him. Mm-hmm. It's as if you can't really prove a negative, so it's, if you've never met somebody, how do you prove that that person doesn't exist?
Well,
the press is always
trying to trot out the families. Do you think they have been queued up to not trot out the families of the crisis actors?
Well, they did trot out a lot of families for Sandy Hook, and I think that those Sandy Hook families were in many cases just invented.
Mm-hmm.
They may not even be related to each other. Their behavior was very strange. Some of them were giggling while they were talking about their recently murdered loved one. So I think that in most cases, almost the whole thing is fake. The one person in this that I know is real is Carlos Arredondo. He still is traveling the country with the coffin of his son and taking donations. And he's, you know, kind of a scam artist to the high order. So I do know that he is a real person, Carlos Arredondo. He's not a crisis actor, but for most of the rest of them, I think they are.
Okay, thank you.
Can I add something real quick, Ken?
No. Oh, I'm sorry.
Real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to point out, too, that the video that Sheila mentioned, I don't know if it was all Boston Globe or some of it was. You would know that, Sheila. But
which video do you mean? The first one? The first one I mentioned in the article?
I guess any video that we can look at of what happened.
Well, there were two. Anyway, there was one that was taken by the Boston Globe, and then there was one that was taken from the media deck over the race.
Okay, so I just wanted to point out that there are multiple examples. And I think this comes up in Dave McGowan's series, I think, if I'm not mistaken, multiple examples of where there are media reports where they'll interview one of the victims, and there'll be a whole account of, you know, I was with my wife, and her leg was blown off, and the whole thing. And then you look at the video, and you figure out who that person is, and the video absolutely does not corroborate what these people said in interviews. And there are numerous examples of this, where it's simply a completely different story in the video than what we, you know, all these sort of heroic stories that we heard about in the printed press. So I just want to throw that in.
Okay. And finally, Barbara?
A couple, I'll be very quick. Two very relevant comments and questions. The first comment is, Fletcher Prouty is on YouTube. You should see it. It's easy to Google or go to YouTube and find it. Fletcher Prouty saying that he was flying over the United States with a high-level CIA officer, and they looked down, and the CIA officer said, "See that town down there? It's all ours. Every person in it."
Wow.
And the implication, and that's years and years ago. The implication is it's like Sandy Hook. That's number one. Number two. Personally, I think that it's dangerous to overstate the situation or the conclusion in the title of this book. It's an excellent book, but I think it's dangerous to say that no one died.
Well, I agree, and I wasn't had nothing to do with the title.
Oh no! I understand that. This is not a criticism of anybody on the call. I just in general. Just because they're crisis actors doesn't mean that somebody didn't piggyback a real bomb. So those are my two comments. But here's the question. At the very beginning, if I recall correctly, the first anomaly or contradiction, as I recall, was that I believe it was the younger brother's backpack. Either it was the wrong color for the one they claimed was on the ground that exploded, or it had the wrong color logo. I'm just surprised that Craig didn't mention that. So my question is, why not? And my other question is, if I recall correctly, wasn't it claimed by officialdom that the younger brother got shot in the throat? So if so, how was he able to testify at all at a trial? Okay, those are my questions.
Yeah, I think I did actually mention the backpack.
He did.
I believe so. You can actually, not only can you see that the backpack that blew up is black, but you can also see that it appears to have the same white-shaped, almost like a square white logo on it, that is the exact same logo that you see on all the backpacks of the guys with the black caps and the skull logos that appear to be from Kraft International. And there's even a case where you see one of those...
completely different from the brothers, right?
Completely different. The brother, especially the younger brother, his backpack was mostly white with some gray and a little bit of black, but... it was completely different, and the indictment of the younger brother specifically talks about the black backpack. So he's charged with, you know, blowing up a bomb in this black backpack, which the video proves he didn't have. So, and I think Jack Graham made that point on our call a few months ago, is that he should be considered innocent just on that basis alone.
Right. And what about
official claim that he was shot in the throat, which makes finding an alleged confession a month later on the inside of the hull of a boat rather convenient.
Yes, well, that's right. I do deal with this as well in the... it'd be great if people wanted to sort of get a better sense. I skipped over my stuff so fast, it's kind of hard to do an 8,000-word article in 10 minutes.
Yes.
But it definitely, there were claims that were made, and then they were taken back. And at one point, they said he was shot in the throat. Another time, they said that it appeared to be more like a knife wound. So... and then originally they said that it was an exchange of gunfire, and then later on they had to admit that it was all a shooting was coming from one side. And there's also the whole thing about the older brother. There's video of somebody who looks exactly like the older brother being taken into police custody, completely without any clothes on, being put into a police car in that general vicinity, and then later on he ends up dead. And you can even see his body with a sort of a big wound on his chest, like looks like, I don't know what, it looks like somebody hit him with a machete or something, but and the aunt, I believe his aunt said that the person in the video being arrested was definitely Tamerlan. So she claims that she believes that he was murdered in police custody.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Mother. Okay, so, well, that was truly an eye-opening review, and we should thank our co-authors for alerting us to this book. Hopefully people will be interested enough to at least pursue the article on Truth and Shadows, and perhaps pick the book up. Okay, we're at announcements now. Does anybody have any quick announcements before we sign off?
This is Bill Wilt. Barbara sent around the law review article on the right of a congressperson to speak up in the House or the Senate. Well, I think you should all read it. It's 33 pages. It's pretty good. There's another right that the U.S. citizens have, and that is to have their Congress publish a record. And so the fact that the 28 pages was not published might be a hook. And thanks for sending it to me, Barbara. And I came in on the call late.
Yeah, if you don't have that, Ken, I'll send it to you, and you can post it if you like.
All right, send it to Craig, please. Okay.
Oh, to Craig. Okay, we'll do
this. And Ken, your audio is really muddy sounding.
Oh, is it? Okay. And let's see, Dave, you had a quick announcement for us?
Right. Yes, it was very great success leafleting in the Chicago area and Northwestern about Zdeněk Mazant, who is the foremost defender of the OCT in American academia. I gave out about 900 business cards, and our website got about 40,000 hits, MazantMisconduct.com, 40,000 hits the first 10 days, and... The line I came up with for the last 2 days, which is so successful, disagreement about Newton's third law. We're talking about building a website, a generic website, for people to use at other colleges. And Tony Zambodi has helped with the current website. We're having a meeting at 2 o'clock on Sunday, Eastern Time. Is anybody on this call want me to make sure you're come to that conference call? Anybody who likes organizing at colleges?
Hey, David, yeah. This is Steve Cohn here. I'd like to be in on that.
Great. Same email?
Yeah, sure.
Why don't you give it to me just in case?
Okay. Steve911. Truther at Hotmail.
Great. Anybody else?
I have a brief announcement, Barbara.
Okay, Barbara. Thank you, David. Barbara, you're next.
Yeah, I just want to remind people that I'm running for Congress here in California Congressional District 20. I've had six
this candidate debate in which I've come out swinging on 9/11 Truth. And by this weekend, I will have links to the audios of FAME that are going out over radio drive time here in the Monterey Peninsula, California.
Wow.
Mm. Yep, have some alone. What?
Holy smokes.
Make sure we get the link.
I'm looking like a taker in my congressional race, Barbara. Congratulations.
Oh, who is that speaking?
Bill Wolf.
Oh, you're running too, Bill.
Yeah. Fifth congressional.
That's great. Well, everybody should know I'm running against Leon Panetta, former CIA director and Secretary of Defense's son, James Panetta. I'm going to give him a run for his money.
No contest. All right.
I don't know about that. It's a heavily Democratic district, and he's the blessed only Democrat in the race. But there are only five of us, and I'm the Bernie Sanders independent, so I have a chance.
All right. Yep. Right on his coattails. Okay. All right. Well, with that, I think we're ready to close for tonight. Remember again that our agenda for the next, for the May teleconference is open now since the debate between Barbara and Craig and Adam will be postponed. So be sure to get your agenda items in on time, and we'll see you on the 25th of May. Okay? Good night, everybody.
Great. Good night.
Great.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Good night.
Bye.